thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 10 for the 18th of July, 2007. Risky Business, Blogs on Campus. I'm Dan Cohen. We're back once again with another episode of Digital Campus and excited to be here once again with our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
Good to talk to you both again. Well, so have you bought an iPhone in the past 2 weeks? Or
not me. Have not. Have not.
Tom,
and
you? No. No. Although I probably should tell our audience that as we were warming up for the podcast, I accidentally had a little Freudian slip and said that I was going to get my iPhone when I meant to say my iPod. So clearly it has deeply penetrated my brain. And I will end up after a glass of Merlot in an Apple store near me with a credit card. And yeah, that should be pretty good.
Sad when our secret objects of desire have become personal technology items.
Right, right. And as the case may be, we've actually lined up for this week's news roundup the Can These Technologies Really Change Our Lives and History edition of the Digital Campus Roundup. And first, we actually had a little humorous tidbit on the iPhone, which everyone still seems to believe will change everyone's lives. And we were talking about, in particular, you know, would it change everyone's lives on campus? And I was saying, you know, that the one owner of an iPod in our group at the Center for History and New Media was, you know, saying how that it was relatively easy to get onto the Mason network, the wireless network. But I was sort of worrying about this, of what happens in the fall when all of those students show up with their shiny iPhones and start wanting to connect right off the bat with Mason's supposedly ubiquitous and this and this and this and this. It seems like this has already started to happen at Duke University. I don't know if you, did the two of you see this story, which just broke, I think, yesterday, but evidently there's already some iPhone users who are trying to automatically log into the Duke's network, and it is shutting down their Cisco routers with requests, and it's the middle of the summer, and I'm sort of wondering what will happen when 10,000 students show up in about a month from now.
Well, they're going to have a serious crisis on their hands if a lot of their students bought iPhones, or if they can't fix the issue with the way that the phones are requesting addresses on the network.
Yeah, it sounds.
And it is a problem. It is a problem for even, you know, here at George Mason, you know, even in just in our building, we've got all these wireless access points. I mean, it's full coverage. But as you walk from one part of our offices to another with your laptop, you switch which access point you're on, and it can cause some pretty serious problems when you're still trying to connect to the access point down the hall, but you're now in the bubble of another access point. It does cause some problems even there. So even within our building, so I think as kids are walking around campus, it's going to be kind of a mess.
Yeah, and I think some of the use cases I've seen for, you know, bringing the iPhone into the classroom, I just don't know that this is going to work with, let's say, a big lecture course with, you know, 500 students or 100 students all trying to kind of seamlessly connect to these different access points. And if they have, you know, I guess the Duke administrators were saying it was MAC address requests, and now some other people are blaming the Cisco routers. I think it's going to seriously up the usage of these Wi-Fi networks because no one will be wanting to use the edge network, because as we found out, as I found out trying to use the phone, it's painful. And so everyone on campus is going to want to be online all the time in a way that I think the laptops really aren't. You know, the laptops, you kind of go to the library, you might set up there, you might use an access point there, you might go to your office and maybe plug into the Ethernet. But we're really talking about, you know, in our case, 30,000 potential iPhone users walking around, assuming it will be like a cell phone where it automatically transfers you from tower to tower. And I don't think that's going to work.
Well, and even if
they still don't know, Duke still doesn't know, right, why this is happening.
I think they've, you know, called in the Cisco ambulance and they're trying to figure it out. But they think it might be that the iPhones were first connected to a home router, and that the iPhone then is constantly pinging through the air, you know, radio signal saying, "Hey, home router, are you still there?" And what they're giving requests to the Duke infrastructure, and that's eating up the kind of network cycles or the router cycles as it tries to answer those requests.
Well, it raises a real issue in terms of just providing those kinds of wireless services on campus generally. I mean, here, you know, certain buildings are dedicated with a wireless network in them, but our older classroom buildings are not. Like the building that the history department is in here at George Mason has no wireless access except as it's been paid for by individual departments. And so, you know, they have to put up their own wireless service if they want wireless in a classroom down the hall, and they have to pay for it themselves. And so the university is eventually going to have to start doing this because, I mean, I'm teaching a graduate course this summer, and half a dozen of the students in the class bring their laptops in, and they can't imagine that they can't connect to a wireless router somewhere in the building. And if, you know, if it's this kind of episodic installation of routers, and then they get overwhelmed with all these new devices like the iPhone and like the, I guess it's, is it Sprint Nextel or was it Singular that announced also a phone that's going to access the internet at the, in the same ways, that, you know, all our students are going to want that kind of nonstop access to Facebook or whatever. And so they're just going to overwhelm the infrastructure.
Right. I mean, I guess that's something that we hadn't considered, was that this is really the first mainstream phone that has a Wi-Fi connection. I mean, there have been phones now for a couple of years now that will transfer between Wi-Fi and the cell tower, but this is really the first mainstream phone, and we've never seen what it might, you know, what might happen when that collides with, you know, campus networks or networks anywhere else. It'll be interesting to see what happens there.
I don't know. The one thing I'd say here, though, is that this could just be a local problem. Like, I don't think it's right to assume that, like, September classes are going to start and, you know, two-thirds of all the students are going to have iPhones. I mean, they are $700 or $600. And, you know, I think there'll be a handful who do have the iPhones, but I think most of them are still going to have, you know, the regular old, you know, $50 flip phone from the carrier. And
right, right.
I think we probably will have time to catch up.
Well, we'll see what happens. As we continue our theme of can this technology change your life and history, Mills, you came across a really interesting story in the Washington Post about, again, cell phones. In this case, in China, and their use as a form of networking for political reasons. What was your take on the story? Can you fill in our audience on what happened?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting story because, and it worked great for me this summer because the class that I'm teaching is about 1989 in Eastern Europe and China, and so we've spent a lot of time thinking about the Tiananmen Square protests of 1989, and the story was about an environmental protest in southern China along the coast. Somebody was going to build a chemical factory on a plant on an island right off the coast of a popular beach, and so people in the local area they organized via text messaging to protest this event because it's very difficult to organize protests in China for a whole variety of reasons of regime surveillance, and so they using text messaging, which is virtually impossible to surveil, they organized this protest, and about 10,000 people showed up and made enough of a statement that now the planners in the local economic development zone are rethinking the installation of this this plant. So there was, you know, it was the story, the first part of the story, which was very interesting about how the technology changes things, is that it's facilitated the organization of a protest in a place where it's very difficult to do that kind of thing. And then there's the history dimension comes in, and this is where it gets really problematic, because the reporter interviewed a couple of people who said, well, and if they'd only had text messaging in 1989, then the whole Tiananmen Square protest movement would have turned out differently. And my response to that was, or not. there's no good evidence that having some other method of communication would have caused the Tiananmen Square business to turn out differently, because the single most important factor in why it turned out the way that it did is that the People's Liberation Army was 100% behind the government and was doing the bidding of the government and was more than happy to crack down on the students. And so having text messaging, okay, maybe more people would have been in the square that night on June the 3rd, and so instead of somewhere between 300 and 3,000 people dying, it might have been between 500 and 5,000 people dying. But the army was going to crack down on that, and there's just no documentary evidence to sustain the idea that any other communication system might have changed the outcome. So, you know, this is, I think, a really good example of how, A, technology can change a present reality, but then projecting the technology back into the past just doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is, it's kind of representative of a larger tendency we have, I think all people have, but especially kind of geeks like us, to kind of impart more importance and power onto the technologies that we use than they probably really have, and especially the kind of the latest and greatest technologies. We think, you know, these are going to change the world. And I think, you know, we sort of – that was sort of my comment at the end of our iPhone discussion, you know, went to that, where, like, you know, this may bring down the routers all over our campuses, but, you know, it may not. And, you know, the iPhone may change education, but it probably won't. And I do think we all have a tendency, and especially people like us who are really heavily involved in technology, to give them a much greater weight than they may really have. And I think just for all of us digital humanists in general, I think it's an important thing always to keep in mind that, to be modest in our claims, at least try to be modest in our claims for the power of the technologies and these new methods that we're trying to develop.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think it's one of the things that I think a good role for academics in, you know, this rapidly changing world of technology is to play the doubter, or to play a little bit, you know, have more shades of gray in terms of our assessment of technology. Because if you just read, you know, the TechCrunch blog, and actually they sometimes do a good job there of saying when new technologies may or may not change the game. But how many posts have I read on blogs like that over the last year or two saying this Web 2.0 company changes the game and it's going to, you know, radically, you know, and then 3 months later, you've never heard of the company again.
Then they post the announcement in the Deadpool.
Right. Now, say, we're adding this company to Deadpool. We really thought their business model was fantastic and it was going to revolutionize education, but it didn't. And I think doing this kind of counterfactual history, Mills, that you were talking about, is probably a great way to sort of introduce that theme of, you know, maybe being a little hesitant about new technologies when you think back at historical cases like Tiananmen.
Yeah, and the example I gave my students was, well, and if the Romans had machine guns, then they would have been able to fight off those barbarians.
Right. Well, our final technology that may or may not change the world is Second Life. And I can't remember if we've discussed it on the podcast, but have either of you spent any time in Second Life?
I went in when the buzz first got started. I went in and, you know, I created an avatar and I wandered around for about an hour and basically wasn't willing to spend money, so therefore wasn't able to do very much. But I thought, okay, this is kind of interesting. And then about a week later, I thought, well, I'll go back and, you know, poke around a little bit more. And by then, George Mason had blocked access through the campus network. So I just stopped.
Huh. And Tom?
Yeah, I had sort of a similar experience where I, you know, spent a half an hour and looked around. I think, you know, Second Life could be one of these examples of one of these overblown technologies, and maybe I'm just behind the curve or something, but I don't see it being, I think it got an awful lot of hype in the period from, you know, maybe 6 months ago, and I'm actually already starting to see some of that hype die down. You don't see quite as much on the museum blogs and on the scholarly blogs and on the library blogs about Second Life as you did 6 months ago, and it just doesn't seem. I mean, I think it's cool. I think it's something that, like, we got to keep our eye on, and I think it has a lot of potential, but it's not, you know, immediately paradigm changing right. in the way that people maybe said it was.
Well, the reason we raised it this week in the news roundup is that the MacArthur Foundation has actually committed pretty significant funds to to operating in Second Life, and they've given a grant to USC to stage discussions and events on issues like migration and education. And for those who don't know, the MacArthur Foundation is really spending a considerable amount of money. I think it's about $50 million to sort of study new technologies and the millennials, you know, this generation that's up and coming that are all digital natives and use all this technology. And they're trying to sort of better understand education in this virtual world and democracy and politics and culture and social, you know, the social aspect of these technologies. And so I think for obvious reasons, they've thought that, you know, they need to do some things in Second Life. Just to say that, I'm just like the two of you. I only spent a couple hours there as a giant squirrel one evening and didn't find much of interest, although I did bump into a couple of other squirrels while I was there. So that was fun. It's interesting to see, like, well, what is the hype curve on Second Life right now? I don't know if the two of you saw this, but there was an article in the LA Times where, you know, they really looked into this quote of 8 million users of Second Life, but really when you kind of push on that number, it ends up being probably under 100,000, you know, real users, and at any at the maximal times, there's 30 to 40,000 people in Second Life. So it's ended up being, I think, a lot smaller just because there's a lot of people like us who probably spent a couple hours as a squirrel or as a giant bald person. We'll track Second Life. I know that probably some in the audience are avid Second Life users, so we would love to hear from you on our blog at digitalcampus.tv. Tell us, so why do you think Second Life is game-changing? Or if you're a skeptic, we'd also like to hear from you, and you can just comment on this episode, which will be, are we already on 10? My goodness. Big episode 10 here. So
episode 10. Wow.
Amazing. Like to hear from people and why they believe Second Life will be important. I should say that I think, Tom, your sense of the curve is about right, because when I was out giving a talk at Stanford on Zotero, there was a simultaneous talk on museums in Second Life, and it was packed, and my session was more sparsely attended, and all the people in it, as soon as my session was over, ran out the door so that they could catch the tail end of the Second Life session. So
well, we should. One other thing we should do is we should bring on Dave Lester, who works with us here at CH&M, who has done, I think, you know, to be fair, a lot more thinking on this than we have, and has spent a lot more time in Second Life than we have, and is doing some research on a particular community in Second Life that is interested in recreating Old West towns in Second Life, and and creating kind of like a kind of Wild West theme park in Second Life, and he has some pretty interesting insights on that on his blog, Finding America. So we'll bring Dave
okay,
on.
Okay, maybe we'll have give
a little more informed opinion.
Big Second Life or Virtual Worlds feature story on a future podcast. Yeah, Mills.
Yeah, and I'll just add one other piece to that. You know, I think there's a lot of hope that virtual worlds like Second Life are going to revolutionize education. And certainly for K-12 education, it's just not going to be usable, and that's because one of the primary user groups of users in Second Life are people who are there for virtual sexual contact, and so any website where that is a heavy use will simply be unavailable to any public school in the United States. And so, you know, there's no public school principal who's going to allow their teacher to direct students to a website where there's lots of virtual sex going on.
Well, one technology that we do feel has taken off and has sustained and indeed increased its impact in society. Indeed, the Wall Street Journal reported last week that it's the 10th anniversary of blogging, although some people think it goes back far beyond that. Some people say it went back to 1995, and actually Boing Boing, one of the most prominent blogs, one of the top five blogs in the world, actually started out as a zine, as a paper zine even earlier on, and then got onto listservs and all that stuff. So it is this episodic, chronological posting of thoughts and ideas has been around for some time. And the three of us, of course, have blogs, so we have committed ourselves to this technology and think it has something to offer. And we thought it'd be a good idea, particularly this week, to talk about blogging, its advantages, disadvantages, and even maybe its risks in academia and museums and libraries. Simply because there was an interesting case over the past week, and I'm not sure if the two of you sort of followed what happened on my blog and on History News Network and about this, but there was a blogger, an anonymous blogger, and I'll tell you the feedback that I got about it in a second, but an anonymous blogger, or I guess it would be a blogger operating under a pseudonym, PhD in history, and who was writing a lot about sort of the state of academia and history and hiring and all these issues that I think are really important, particularly to graduate students. And indeed, this person was a graduate student at an unnamed university. And he was writing a lot of, I think, very interesting, in-depth blog posts and thought through some of the issues. I disagreed with him or her quite a bit, but I thought it was a very important new blog, and it got recognized actually by the American Historical Association blog as being a really important counterpoint to some of the stats that they produce in Perspectives, which is the, sort of the official monthly magazine of the American Historical Association. And, because PhD in history was this anonymous grad student blogging about lots of things relating to hiring and the job market and so forth, inevitably, I think it engendered this interest in trying to unmask the blogger, and I guess the pursuers got a little too close for comfort over the weekend, and PhD in history deleted his or her entire blog, and that's when I sort of got involved, I guess, if it's that case. And I have no idea really how much influence I had, although I did hear from PhD in history directly, he's been sending me emails for quite some time, again, under his pseudonym. But, I wrote this long post about how, this has been a little pet peeve of mine. I kind of feel that there are, a small number of cases where anonymous blogging is a okay thing to do in academia. But I kind of feel like if you're an academic, you write stuff and you got to open yourself up to criticism and you got to stick your neck out. And so I wrote a blog post saying, I thought PhD in history should just relaunch his or her blog under their own name. And luckily this is indeed what happened. You can now go to phdinhistory.blogspot.com. He was at a WordPress blog and he's now moved his stuff there. And I'm not going to actually say his name or where he's from. He is a grad student, and I'm really glad to see him blogging again. But I think the whole episode, as it played out, there was some interesting back and forth on the History News Network about whether, whether anonymity is a good thing or a bad thing, and whether it's too dangerous for graduate students and professors to blog because of the tenure process and whether you could piss someone off. And I think it's just a good time to sort of pause on this podcast and sort of think through some of the issues and why we got started blogging, again, what the sort of risks are involved in it, and I think many advantages to blogging. So maybe we could start off just, you know, Mills, how did you start blogging and why, and what do you think the blog has done for you in general?
I started blogging, it's been almost 2 years now, it's hard to imagine, it'll be 2 years in October, and I started doing it largely because, you know, I have this interest in technology and history education, and I just didn't really want to write more articles about it. I'd written a number of articles, and I was satisfied with what I'd written, and I wanted to write kind of shorter things and try out ideas and play with them a little bit and really be able to communicate those ideas in a quicker way than writing an article, sending it to a journal, waiting for the review, finally seeing it in publication 6 months later, at which point everything I'd written about involving technology was already outdated. So that's really, I guess it's that question of not being outdated that got me started. Mm-hmm. And also it was a way for me to communicate with my students about the things that I'm personally interested in my own research and in my own teaching. And so, because, you know, students are really interested in their professors and the kind of work that they're doing. And so this was an easy way to do that. In terms of what it's done for me, you know, a simple example in terms of visibility as a faculty member for your ideas is since the 1st of May, I've had 15,000 unique visitors to my blog. And the last time I looked, my most recent book was ranked something like 2,485,000 something something in the Amazon.com sales ranking. So I think certainly a lot more people are accessing my work through my blog than will ever access my work through conventional publication. So so it's been very good that way. And I've made some new friends, some new colleagues. I've been asked to speak at a number of conferences, staff development workshops, that kind of thing. So, you know, if the purpose of one of the purposes of being a faculty member is to circulate knowledge among peers and the public, well, then the blog is much better than conventional publication.
Okay, great. Tom, how about you? How did you get started, and what do you see are some of the major advantages of having a blog? And we should mention, Mills, by the way, congratulations. You actually got tenure, and you have a blog.
Yes, I did.
So,
that's right.
You know, some of these people who – oh, I didn't mention. So
it can happen.
Yeah. So out of my emails, I got 12 emails, and there's a bunch of, like, comments on the on HNN. But I'd say they were about 10 to 1 against my – my thought that anonymity is a bad thing. So I don't know. Maybe it was just the vocal people, but it was interesting that a lot of people thought I was wrong on this point. Tom, how did you get started, and what do you see the blog doing for you?
Yeah, I got started because my interest is in public history, history among the public. And in particular in amateur history. And I've never really done any serious thinking or serious writing on amateur history. The way that I've sort of engaged it has been by and large, and this has been for kind of several years, sort of haphazardly and occasionally, actually in much the same way that amateur historians tend to go about their work. And so, you know, I'll come across things, and I've been, you know, in my own bookmarks on the web, and in notes I've just sort of taken, and in little scraps of paper here and there, I would come across instances of ordinary people, amateurs, non-professionals doing history in unconventional places, like well, for instance, today I was driving down the highway and I was noticing, you know, just how many license plates have historical themes to them. You know, North Carolina is first in flight, and, you know, Virginia has a Jamestown 2007 license plate. And, you know, and I've been collecting those kinds of little examples of popular history, amateur history, for a couple of years now. And I kind of, when a bunch of you guys, you know, Mills and Dan and other colleagues here at CH&M started launching their blogs, I saw in the format a really good place to log these, you know, kind of haphazard findings. It just the format, the technology, the chronological and kind of informal structure of it just matches the way that I have been doing this work anyway. And so it was kind of a good mix of or match of form and function. And I also thought that, you know, it being my interest being in public history, I should be logging these things publicly. There's no reason for me to be sitting on them until I decide, you know, if or when I want to publish something on them. I should be putting them out and getting feedback from the public and seeing if there's any audience for it. Fortunately, there's been a decent sized audience for it, and the technology's really matched my interest and my way of working, and I think it's for me been a really great way of moving forward with this little project I've had.
Right. Well, I totally agree with what you said. I think like the two of you, I think the delay in publication is becoming increasingly annoying. I had really what sort of spurred me to start blogging was that in 2002, I went to a conference at Cambridge University, and that I spent a lot of time writing a paper for, that was going to be a chapter of a book on Victorian history, and so I went to this conference and figured, okay, well, maybe the book will be out in 2003 or so after they edit everybody's essays down. And 2003 went by, and then 2004 went by, and then 2005 went by, it was that at that point that I realized that this very snide old Cambridge Don wasn't joking when, at the end of the conference, when the sort of organizer of the conference said, "Well, thank you very much for all of the papers that you've given, and we're really looking forward to getting this volume out," and this guy who's sitting next to me leaned over and said, "Don't hold your breath." So, and he was absolutely right. I shouldn't have held my breath. And it just seems like in an increasingly digital world that delay is sort of unnecessarily painful. And especially for academics, where I think, Mills, your point about, we're in the business of sharing knowledge. This is like a perfect format for doing that. And I think that, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think it's also especially important, for, the scholarship, let's say in Victorian mathematics that you study, Dan, the scholarship there moves, it moves ahead, but a delay of 2 years when you're writing about Victorian mathematics maybe isn't.
Right,
it's not prohibitive.
True. Right,
but if you're writing about let's say digital history, and the latest tools in digital history, if you have a 2 or 3 year publication delay, I mean, you might as well not write the article or the book.
Right,
I mean,
that's right.
Because 2 or 3 years from now, everything's going to be different. And so for digital humanists who are working in the field of digital humanities, and I think in some ways there's not really a viable traditional publication alternative to something like a blog.
Right.
And I think, we can talk about what the different variations or varieties of blogs there are, because I think there are lots of different options for people who want to start blogs. They're not all the same. And I think, the three of us, we all have blogs, but they're all very different in their approach and in their structure and in their frequency and everything else. So.
Right. So I think that's a good first, thing to discuss is sort of, well, someone who doesn't have a blog, how would they get started? I think just to my quick two cents is, I think you really need to think, well, what is the purpose of my blog? What am I blogging for? What am I going to blog about? And I think, Tom, your point is a really good one. I very intentionally did not start a blog on Victorian history, although there are some very good blogs on Victorian history. But I've sort of kept very close to the digital stuff just because I felt the expiration date on a lot of my thoughts in that realm was shorter than the print publication cycle. So it felt like a good place to do that for certain things, and maybe a little bit less so for other things. Although I think now that I've seen some very good Victorian history blogs, I thought, maybe there's a second blog in there. But I think thinking of a theme that you're going to stick to and And sticking to it is very important. And also not the temptation, I think, with a blog, because it's so easy to post, is to go off and discuss, you know, what you're going to have for breakfast or what have you. And, I think it's a real danger with a blog. You need to, or what movie you saw that you really like that is off topic. I think at least for an academic blog, and again, I think this is mostly for blogs where, you know, you have a serious professional reason for doing a blog, you really need to keep it close to your original purpose.
I really want to second that. I mean, I have to resist the temptation all the time to sound off on political issues of the day or
totally
things like that, because I am aware that I actually have an audience for my blog, and there are things that, you know, go on in the world that really tick me off, and I want to blast off in my blog about it. But that is not what my blog is about, and that's not why I've built up a base of regular subscribers. I mean, they aren't subscribing to my blog to hear what I think about the war in Iraq or the politics of my local community. They're subscribing to read about my take on history, technology, East European history. Those are the things that they're subscribing to find out about. And if I start doing that, I'm going to lose subscribers right away. So, I think you do have to think through what it is that you're going to write about, and then stick to that, so that there's your subscribers know what they're going to get.
Right, right. What are some other risks that you guys see? I mean, do you think at this risk of doing it? I mean, you know, my blog is just dancohen.org. Everybody knows who I am. Am I naive in thinking that the opportunities for getting your name out there, advancement, all the, you know, reputation, all that outweigh the possible negatives of saying something, you know, that someone might not like who will be on a future hiring committee? Or, I think a lot of the email I got were from people who are grad students or who are very sympathetic of grad students, of which I was one at some point some years ago. But saying, you know, boy, it's a really tenuous situation you're in as a graduate student. You know, you might not get a job for anything you write on your blog. You know, am I underestimating that criticism that you could say something that a hiring committee might use against you?
Well, you could write something that a hiring committee might use against you. They might disagree with a footnote in one of your articles. I think that I'm on your side on this one. I think that it is. I mean, if you're worried about what you might say getting used against you, then don't say things that might get used against you in your blog. Say them to your friends over a beer at the pub, but don't put them out there for everybody to read. I mean, there's appropriate speech in a public forum and not appropriate speech in a public forum, and depending on the audience. And so, I mean, there are things that, you know, I say to my friends that I would never say in front of my parents. And so I think it's the same kind of issue.
Right, right.
I think you just have to keep in mind that if you decide to start blogging, it becomes a part of your professional identity. It is you're putting yourself out there. And you do have to think about, how you're portraying yourself and what your blog says about you. I think the mistake people make is assuming that what they say on the internet is, and I think Mills, what you were getting at this, that what they say on the internet is not going to be part of, you know, the hiring and promotion process.
Right.
And it is. But if you know that, and you know that going into it, you make accommodation for that, and you don't say things in this private public, I mean, in this public place that you wouldn't say in some other public place. And I think people just need to be aware of that. I think the fact that there are so many blogs that are so, personal and so, ill-conceived and these are blogs in the sort of general sphere. So many blogs that are really too revealing, I think, makes people wary of blogging in general.
Right.
But just the fact
right.
that there are some bad blogs out there doesn't mean that you shouldn't blog at all. There are bad magazines out there, but you wouldn't hesitate to write a magazine article. So I just think you just need to think these things through.
And you know, I had a sort of a bigger gray area on this. I was speaking about blogging at a conference in June, and one of the participants in the session asked me a question about writing style. So it wasn't about what I was saying; it was more about the style that I was writing in. Because in my blog, I write what is probably best described as casual academic. And so it is still seems like an academic is writing it, but I write in a much more casual way than I would in an article that I would submit to a journal. And so
that's a really important point. The writing style. Yeah.
So he asked me about that, and I said, well, you know, people don't read blogs to read academic writing. They read blogs to read more sort of casual academic writing, in my view, to hear the kind of more, I don't know. I keep saying casual, but it's sort of the more unvarnished style
right.
of writing.
But you're
more entertaining.
That's another possible risk is, you know, if you're writing more like you'd write in an instant messaging window, that's not a style that's going to serve you well. And you know, yeah, when I started, I adopted very consciously a particular, you know, a sort of casual academic, I think, is a good way of putting it. I can't remember how I phrased it, but a sort of rationalist with, you know, bits of humor here and there, because my God, who would, you know, you don't read a blog to get like the total rationalist take on something with tons of footnotes. So I think there is probably a good middle position. And I think the danger is you let in, you know, too much casualness into it. You know, what I admired in PhD in history's work is that they had adopted exactly that tone. I mean, this was stuff that, you know, could have been published in Perspectives, you know, and it had some lighthearted aspects and some, you know, hand-wringing parts to the prose. But, you know, it was serious stuff that, you know, you'd read in a blog format. So I thought there was a lot to recommend it. How do you guys... Go ahead, Tom.
I think blogs are serving... Kind of a real need among academics too for a more casual outlet for their thoughts, and possibly for a kind of a more stylistic outlet for their thoughts. I mean, if you go back and you read, you know, the Journal of American History from years ago, you'll find that the writing style is actually like less formal than you get in the Journal of American History today. There's kind of more room for poetry and for personal kind of style and for literary flourish than there really is in like the Journal of American History today and in most scholarly journals today. And I think kind of the professionalization, the increasing professionalization of the humanities, of history in this case, has led to has been in some ways sort of stultifying in terms of writing. And I think blogs provide a way for, you know, you can still write in that style that you need to write in to be, you know, to go through the peer review process and to get an article published. But on your blog, you can be a little more yourself. And I think, you know, I think it's serving a need that maybe journals used to serve and aren't really serving anymore.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, I know from Victorian journals, there used to be very large sections of these journals for sort of notes and news and sort of shorter form communications between, you know, academics and the public in certain of these popular intellectual journals. And I do think it fits a nice role there that can fit into, you know, the spectrum of academic production. I mean, I don't think books are going away. I don't think articles are going away. I think blogs sort of take up part of that spectrum that really there wasn't anything there. Well, it seems like we have to do parts 2, 3, and 4 on blogging at some point. I think our regular viewers like to know that we like to keep the show under an hour and preferably closer to 45 minutes, so we don't bore you completely to death. And I think we'll revisit blogging again and talk about some of these other risks, like are you giving away your research, and are people going to steal what you're doing, and all of these worries that people have about blogging, because I think we all want to encourage people to blog more within academia. I think it adds a lot of interesting perspectives to the blogosphere and helps reduce the number of posts on Paris Hilton that are out there in the blogosphere. And as we always like to do, we like to end with just a brief going around the table with things that people have found online or maybe off, tools and software and websites that might interest you. Tom, what do you have for this week?
I have something that could maybe be of help to people who are starting to think about launching a blog, a tool that makes it, that incorporates a lot of the tools that I think it really takes to maintain a blog. And I think maybe we'll talk more about why those tools are important in another podcast. But it's the web browser Flock. That's flock.com. It's essentially a flavor of Firefox, although it's built by a commercial entity off the Firefox platform. But it has built into it a lot of the tools that that really make it easy to blog. Among some of those tools are it has social bookmarking services like Magnolia and Delicious built into it. Those are really kind of important for bloggers to keep track of all the things they come across that they may want to blog about. It has a really good Flickr uploader for Flickr photos. Makes it really easy to post photos on Flickr and then to blog those things. It actually has a blog client built right into it, so it allows you to very quickly, if you come across a website or an article or a blog post that you want to comment on in your own blog, makes it very easy to just kind of dump the link and whatever text you want into a new blog post and then post that immediately to your blog directly from within the browser. It has a lot of other features that make it good for bloggers. The one thing I'd say is it's still a piece of beta software. It's in its 0.9 release, I think. There are some things that are a little buggy about it. I've been really trying it out for the last week or so, and certain things don't work as quite as advertised. But if you have a little bit of patience, I think probably the 1.0 release, a lot of those bugs will be worked out. But it is definitely something to take a look at. If you use Firefox, a lot of it will be familiar to you because it is built on the Firefox platform. And I should say that it does work with Zotero. So, Dan, don't worry.
Right.
We're not going to take Zoterons away from you. It is Zotero compatible.
Yeah, we've talked to the Flock team, and they're excited to have Zotero integrated. So, and there are other Firefox extensions that will work with it as well, since it is based on
most
the Firefox platform.
Most of the other ones will work.
Great. Mills, what do you have for this week?
Mine is the David Rumsey map collection from Cartography Associates.
Fantastic.
And it's Rumsey's a map collector who personally owns about 150,000 historical maps, and he's been just putting more and more of them online. At the moment, the website says they have 15,800 historical maps online. And what distinguishes the Rumsey collection from others like the University of Texas Perry Castaneda collection is that the Rumsey collection also comes with a GIS browser, and so it allows you to play with the maps in a whole lot of different ways. It's a little slow still, but it's definitely faster than the last time I looked at it back in April when they loaded up another 1,000 or so new maps. And it's really a wonderful resource for those interested in historical cartography, those who are teaching. There's an incredible selection of maps, and he's really made sure to post these from his collection, maps from all over the world. And so it's not just zoomed in on America or something like that. So it's it's a really great resource both for historical research but also teaching about the past.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable collection, and the scans are so good it's wonderful to use in the classroom. Well, for this week, last week we talked about abundance or 2 weeks ago we talked about abundance and dealing with all the text that's been scanned and put in. And I found it really interesting that Google Books, which I was criticizing for not really making the text that's behind the page images that they put online in their Google Books project, where they're scanning all these books and making them available. And I was saying it's sort of worthless because they don't actually give you the text. They just give you the page images. And all these things that we want to do, all the operations we want to make on the text, we actually need the text itself. Well, since then, actually on the 4th of July, I guess they used Independence Day to liberate the text, but for many public domain books, which is basically books that were published before 1923, if you go to the advanced search page of Google Books and click on the full view option, there's a little button that you can click, view plain text. And for many books, you'll then be able to see what the OCR results are from Google. So these are the text that they've converted, and it's definitely flawed. I mean, particularly some of the books I looked at, you know, from the 18th century were considerably worse if the font or the page images weren't very good. But it is there for some books, and of course, they're still locking it up in a really annoying way that it's very hard to cut and paste the text, and if you want to grab the entire text from a book, it's really hard to do. And at some point, I think they need to cave in and help out the public domain here a little bit. But it is a step forward, and I think for people who are, let's say, doing research on a particular book that is available in this format as a converted text or plain what they're calling view in plain text, it might help you out because you can then grab that text and do searches and do some of the text mining and analysis that we talked about in our last episode. Well, that wraps up today's show, and we hope to hear from you online, via email, or on our blog, and we look forward to another conversation in 2 weeks on Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.